recording the dash to the hospital a little while before. I saw myself cross the silvered landscape and pass, like smoke, through the Hundreds gate. I saw myself start along the Hundreds drive. But there I grew panicked and confused. For the drive was changed, was queer and wrong, was impossibly lengthy and tangled with, at the end of it, nothing but darkness. I woke in daylight, chastened and cramped. It was just after 6. The windows of the car were running with condensation, and my head was bare. My hat had worked its way down between my shoulder and the seat to be crushed beyond recovery, and the blanket was lumped around my waist as if I'd been wrestling with it. I opened the door to the fresh air and climbed awkwardly out. There was a scuffling at my feet. I thought of rats, but it was hedgehogs, a pair of them. They had been nosing at the tires of the car and now disappeared into the long grass. They left dark trails behind them. The grass was pale with dew. The pond had a faint mist across it. The water was grey now instead of white. The place had lost the air of unreality it had had in the early hours. I felt rather as I could remember feeling after a bad air raid in the city, coming blinking out of the shelter, seeing the houses marked but still standing, when in the midst of the worst of the bombing it had seemed as though the world were being blasted to bits. But I felt not dazed, so much simply as washed out. The passion was gone from me. I wanted coffee and a shave, and I needed the lavatory badly. I moved to one side and saw to that. Then I combed my hair and did my best to straighten my crumpled clothes. I tried the car. It was damp and cold and wouldn't start at once, but after I'd lifted the bonnet and wiped the spark plugs, I got it going, the engine hammering open the country silence, frightening the birds from the trees. I drove back along the lane, briefly rejoined the Hundreds road, then turned off towards Lidcote. I met no one on the way, but the village was just coming to life, the labouring families already stirring, the bakery with a smoking chimney. The sun was low and shadows were long, and all the little details on the cobbled church, the red brick houses and the shops, the empty pavements and the carless road, all looked crisp and clean and handsome. My own house sits at the top of the high street, and as I approached it I saw, at the surgery door, a man. He was ringing the night bell, then cupping his hands around his eyes to gaze in through the pane of frosted glass beside the door. He had on a hat and a coat, with the collar up, but I couldn't see his face. I supposed him a patient, and my heart sank. But hearing my car he turned, and then I recognized David Graham. There was something about his pose that made me guess he had brought bad news. When I drew up and saw his expression, I knew it must be very bad. I parked and got out, and he came wearily over. He said, "I've been trying to find you." "Oh, Faraday!" He passed his hand across his mouth. The morning was so silent I heard the rasp of his unshaved chin against his palm. I said, "What is it? Is it Anne?" It was all I could think of. "Anne?" He blinked his tired-looking eyes. "No, it's Faraday. I'm afraid it's Caroline. There's been an accident at Hundreds. I'm so sorry." A telephone call had come out from the hall sometime around 3. It was Betty, in a dreadful state, wanting me. I, of course, was not at home, so the exchange had passed the message on to Graham. He was given no details, told only that he must get out to Hundreds as quickly as he could. He had pulled on his clothes and driven straight there, only to find his way blocked by the chained park gates. Betty had forgotten about the padlock. He tried one gate, then drove around and tried the other, but both were very securely fastened and far too high to climb. He was just on the point of heading home and calling Betty by telephone when he thought of the new council houses and the breach in the park wall. The houses now had rudimentary gardens with chain-link fences at the back. He was able to clamber over one of these fences and make his way up to the hall on foot. Betty answered the door to him, an oil lamp trembling in her hand. She was, he said, beyond hysteria, almost dumb with shock and fear, and as soon as she had let him into the house he could see why. Behind her, in the moonlight, on the pink and liver-coloured marble floor, lay Caroline. She was dressed in her nightgown, the hem of it flung up and twisted. Her legs were bare, her hair seemed spread out like a halo around her head, and for a second, with the shadows so thick, he thought she might simply be lying there in some kind of fit or faint. Then he took the lamp from Betty and went over and, with horror, saw that what he had taken for the spread of Caroline's hair was actually darkening blood. He realized that she must have fallen from one of the upstairs landings. Automatically he looked up, as if for broken banisters. There was nothing amiss. He lit another couple of lamps and briefly examined the body, but it was clear that Caroline was well beyond help. She would have died, he thought, the moment her head had struck the marble. He fetched a blanket and covered her over. Then he took Betty downstairs and brewed some tea. He hoped for an account of what had happened, but Betty, frustratingly, had nothing much to tell him. She had heard Caroline's step on the landing in the middle of the night. Coming out of her room to see what the matter was, she had actually seen Caroline's falling body, then heard the dreadful thump and crack of it hitting the marble below. That was more or less all that she could say. She couldn't bear to think about it. The sight of Caroline plunging down in the moonlight was the most horrible thing she'd ever seen. When she closed her eyes, she could still see it. She thought she'd never be right again. Graham gave her a sedative, and then, just as I had recently done, he picked up the old-fashioned hundreds telephone and called for the police and the mortuary van. He also called me, wanting to let me know what had happened. Again, of course, there was no answer. He thought of the vehicles that would soon be coming, and remembered the fastened park gates. He got the key to the padlocks from Betty and went back across the moonlit park to his own car. He said he was glad to leave the house, and reluctant to enter it again. He felt, irrationally, as if the place had a sickness in it, a sort of lingering infection in its floors and walls. But he stayed through all of the ensuing business, the arrival of the sergeant and the loading of Caroline's body into the van. It was all finished by 5 o'clock. After that, there was only Betty to deal with. She looked so shaken and pathetic, he considered taking her home with him. Again, though, he found himself oddly unwilling to prolong his contact with the hall, but it was out of the question to leave her alone in that frightful setting, so he waited while she put her things together, then drove her the 9.5 miles to her parents' house. He said she shivered all the way. After that he had returned to Lidcote to tell Anne what had happened, and then he'd come looking for me. He said, "There was nothing you could have done, Faraday, and to be honest, I think it's a blessing the call came to me. There would have been no pain, I promise you. But Caroline's injuries, well, they were mostly to the head. It wasn't something you should have seen. I just didn't want you to hear about it from someone else. You were out with a patient, I suppose." We were upstairs by now in my sitting room. He had taken me up there and given me a cigarette, but the cigarette was burning beside me, unsmoked. I was leaning forward in my armchair, my elbows on my knees and my head in my hands. Without lifting my head, I said dimly, "Yes, an acute appendix. It looked bad for a while. I took the man to Leamington myself. Andrews sorted him out." Graham said again, "Well, there was absolutely nothing you could have done. I wish I'd known you were at the hospital, though. I could have reached you sooner there." I was having trouble piecing things together, and it took me a moment to understand him, but finally I realized that he assumed I had been at Leamington all night. I opened my mouth to tell him that, by a wretched coincidence, I'd actually been asleep in my car only a couple of miles from Hundreds when Caroline's fall must have taken place. But as I drew my hands from my face, I remembered the queer state I had worked myself into the night before, and I felt a curious shame about it. So I hesitated, and the moment passed, and then it was too late to speak. He saw my confusion, and misinterpreted it as grief. He said again how desperately sorry he was. He offered to make me tea, cook me up a breakfast. He said he didn't like to leave me on my own. He wanted me to go home with him so that he and Anne could look after me, but to every suggestion I shook my head. When he saw that he couldn't persuade me, he slowly got to his feet. I rose, too, to see him out, and we went downstairs to the surgery door. He said, "You look terrible, Faraday. I do wish you'd come back with me. Anne will never forgive me for not bringing you. Will you really be all right?" I said, "Yes. Yes, I'll be fine. You're not going to sit here brooding. I know it's a lot to take in, but—" He grew awkward. "Don't go torturing yourself with all sorts of useless speculation, will you?" I peered at him. "Speculation? I mean, as to how exactly Caroline died. The post-mortem might shed some light on it. There might have been some kind of seizure, who knows? People are bound to assume the worst, but it was probably an ordinary accident, and we'll simply never know for sure what happened. Poor Caroline. After all she'd been through. She deserved better, didn't she?" I realized I hadn't even begun to wonder what had caused her to fall, as if her death had a sort of inevitability to it that could overpower logic. Then, muddily thinking over Graham's words, I realized something else. I said, "You're not suggesting she did it deliberately. You can't think it was suicide." He said hastily, "Oh, I don't think anything. I only mean because of what happened with her mother. People are bound to wonder. Look, what the hell does it matter? Forget about it, will you?" "But it can't have been suicide," I said. "She must have slipped or lost her balance. That house at night, with the generator off." But I thought of the moonlight that would have come streaming into the stairwell through the dome of glass in the roof. I pictured the solid hundreds banister. I saw Caroline making her sturdy, sure-footed way along those familiar landings and stairs. I stared at Graham, and he must have seen the bewildered churning of my ideas. He put his hand on my shoulder and said firmly again, "Don't think about it. Not now. It's a ghastly thing, but it's finished. It was no fault of yours. There was nothing anyone could have done. You hear me?" And perhaps there is a limit to the grieving that the human heart can do. As when one adds salt to a tumbler of water, there comes a point where simply no more will be absorbed. My thoughts chased themselves in uneasy circles for a time, then wore themselves out. I passed the next few days almost calmly, almost as if nothing much had changed. In a sense, for me, nothing had changed. My neighbours and patients were very kind, but even they appeared to struggle to respond properly to Caroline's death. It had come too soon after her mother's, and was too much of a piece with all the other recent hundreds mysteries and tragedies. There was a certain amount of muted debate about how the fall might have occurred, with most people, as Graham had predicted, favouring suicide, and many, thinking of Roderick, I suppose, mentioning madness. It was hoped that the post-mortem would reveal something. The results of the examination, however, did nothing to clear things up, for they revealed only that Caroline was fit and perfectly healthy. There had been no stroke, no seizure, no heart attack, and no struggle. I would have been bleakly content for the matter to be left there. No amount of debate or speculation would return Caroline to life. Nothing would bring her back to me. But from an official point of view, cause of death had to be determined. As he had after Mrs. Ayres's suicide 6 weeks before, the borough coroner called for an inquest, and since I was the Ayres family doctor, to my very great dismay, I was subpoenaed to attend. I went along with Graham and sat at his side. The day was Monday, the 14th of June. The court was not crowded, but the weather was fine. We were all of us dressed as if for a funeral, in heavy blacks and greys, and the room quickly grew warm. Glancing around me as I sat, I made out the various spectators, the newspaper men, the family friends, Bill Desmond and the Rossiters. Even Seeley, I saw, was there. He caught my eye and inclined his head. Then I spotted Caroline's Sussex uncle and aunt sitting with Harold Hepton. I had heard that they had been to see Roderick, and had been shaken by how they'd found him. News of his sister's death apparently had tipped him into absolute mania. They were staying out at Hundreds, doing what they could to sort out the estate's tangled finances on his behalf. The aunt, I thought, looked ill. She seemed to want to avoid my eye. She and her husband would have heard from Hepton what had happened about the wedding. Proceedings began. The members of the jury were sworn in. The coroner, Cedric Riddle, outlined the case, then started to call forward the witnesses. There were not many of us. The first to go up was Graham, to give a formal account of his attendance at the hall on the night in question, and to offer his conclusions as to the circumstances of Caroline's death. He repeated the post-mortem results, which, in his opinion, ruled out the possibility of any physical crisis. He thought it much more likely, he said, that Caroline had simply fallen through, as he put it, accident or design. The local sergeant went up next. He confirmed that the house had given no sign of having been broken into, with its doors and windows all quite fast. He then produced photographs of Caroline's body, which were passed to the jury and to one or two other people. I didn't see them, and was glad not to. I could tell from the jurors' reactions that the images were grim ones. But the man also had photographs of the hall's second-floor landing, with its sturdy banister rail. Riddle looked closely at those and requested details of the banister's dimensions, its width, its height from the floor. He then asked Graham for Caroline's measurements, and when Graham had hastily looked through his notes and provided them, he had one of his clerks improvise a mock-up of the banister and invited the court secretary, a woman about the same height as Caroline, to stand beside it. The rail came to just above her hip. He asked her how easily she felt she might be tipped, say after stumbling, over a rail at that height. She answered, "Not very easily at all." He asked the sergeant to step down, and then he called Betty to the stand. She, of course, was the chief witness. This was the first time I'd seen her since my last disastrous visit to the hall a fortnight before Caroline's death. She had come to the inquest with her father and had been sitting with him at the side of the room. She made her way forward, a small, slight figure, looking more girlish than ever against that crowd of dark-suited men, her face pale, her colourless fringe pinned up at the side with a crooked grip, just as I remembered seeing it on my first trip to Hundreds nearly a year before. Only her clothes were a surprise to me, used as I was to her parlour-maid's costume. She wore a neat skirt and jacket, with a white blouse beneath. Her shoes had little tapping heels to them, and her stockings were dark, with seams. She kissed the testament with a nervous ducking of her head, but repeated the oath and answered Riddle's preliminary questions in a strong, clear voice. I knew that her words would basically be an elaboration of what she'd already told Graham, and I dreaded having to hear the story again in more detail. I rested my elbows on the table before me and sat with my hand across my eyes. On the evening of the 27th of May, I heard her say, she and Miss Ayres had gone to bed early. The house was in a funny way at that time, because virtually all of its carpets, curtains, and furniture had gone. Miss Ayres was due to leave the county on the 31st, and on the same day Betty herself had arranged to return to her parents. They were spending their final few days, seeing to all the last jobs that had to be done before the house could be handed over to the agents. They had passed that particular day in sweeping and cleaning the empty rooms, and were very tired. No, Miss Ayres had not appeared to be in low spirits, was not dejected in any way. She had worked just as hard as Betty. If anything, she had worked harder. She had seemed to Betty to be looking forward to leaving, though she had not spoken much about her plans. She had said more than once that she wanted the house to be left tidy for whoever should live in it next. Betty had gone to bed at 10 o'clock. She had heard Miss Ayres go into her room about half an hour later. She had heard it very clearly because Miss Ayres's room was just around the landing from her own. Yes, that was the first landing. There was a second landing above, both of them overlooking the hall by the same stairwell, both lit by a glass dome in the roof. At about 2:30 she had been woken by the creak of footsteps out on the stairs. At first she had been frightened. Why was that? Riddle asked her. She didn't quite know. Possibly the house, being large and lonely, was an unnerving one at night? Yes, she supposed that was it. The fear, anyway, had soon passed. She'd realized the steps were Miss Ayres's. She guessed that she had got up, perhaps to go to the lavatory, perhaps to make herself a warm drink in the kitchen downstairs. Then she heard more creaks, and realized with surprise that Miss Ayres was heading not down, but up, to the house's second floor. Why did she think Miss Ayres had done that? She couldn't say. Was there anything up there but empty rooms? No, nothing at all. She had heard Miss Ayres go very slowly along the upstairs passage, as if she was feeling her way through the dark. Then she heard her stop and make a sound. Miss Ayres had made a sound? What sort of sound? She had called something out. Well, what had she called? She had called out, "You." I heard the word and looked up. I saw Riddle pause, gazing hard at Betty through the lenses of his spectacles. He said, "You heard Miss Ayres call out the single word, you?" Betty nodded unhappily. "Yes, sir." "You are quite positive about that. She couldn't simply have been crying out, exclaiming or groaning?"
"Oh, no, sir. I heard it very clear."
"You did? And how exactly did she call it?"
"She called it as if she had seen someone she knew, sir. But as though she was afraid of them, mortal afraid. And after that I heard her running. She came running back towards the stairs. I got out of bed and went over to the door and quickly opened it, and that's when I saw her falling."
"You saw the fall clearly?"
"Yes, sir, because the moon was so bright."
"And did Miss Ayres make any sound as she fell? I know it's a hard thing for you to recall, but did she seem to you to be struggling, or did she drop straight with her arms at her sides?"
She didn't make any sound, only her breath was sort of rushing, and no, she didn't drop straight. Her arms and legs were waving about. They were waving like when you pick up a cat and it wants to be set down.
Her voice had begun to falter on these last words, and now failed her completely. Riddle had one of the court clerks pour her a glass of water. He told her she was being very brave. But I heard all this, rather than saw it. I was leaning forward again with my hand across my eyes, for if a memory had proved too much for Betty, it had very nearly proved too much for me. I felt Graham touch my shoulder.
"All right," he murmured.
I nodded.
"You're sure? You look ghastly."
I straightened up. "Yes, I'm all right." Reluctantly, he drew his hand away. Betty had also recovered by now. Riddle, anyway, was almost finished. He was sorry to have to keep her there, he said. There was one last puzzling point he needed to clear up. She had said a moment ago that in the seconds before she fell, Miss Ayres had called out in fear as if to someone she knew, and that then she had been running. Had there been the sound of any other footsteps, or a voice, any other sound at all, either before the fall or after it?
"No, sir," said Betty.
"There was definitely no other person in the house apart from you and Miss Ayres." Betty shook her head.
"No, sir. That is—"
She hesitated, and the hesitation made Riddle study her more closely. As I've said, he was a scrupulous man. A moment before, he had been ready to ask her to step down. Now he said, "What is it? Do you have something to say?" She said,
"I don't know, sir. I don't like to."
"You don't like to? What do you mean?
You mustn't be bashful or fearful here.
We are here to ascertain the facts. You must tell the truth, as the truth strikes you. Now, what is it?" Biting at the inside of her mouth, she said,
"There wasn't a person in the house, sir. But I think there was something else. Something that didn't want Miss Caroline to leave it."
Riddle looked puzzled.
"Something else?" "Please, sir," she said. "The ghost."
She spoke fairly quietly, but the room was hushed. The words carried clearly across it, making a great impression on the gathering. There were murmurs. One person even laughed. Riddle glared around the court, then asked Betty what on earth she meant. And, rather to my horror, she began earnestly to tell him. She told him about the house having been, in her expression, jumpy. She said a ghost lived in it, that it was this ghost that had made Jip bite Gillian Baker Hyde. She said that then the ghost had started fires, and the fires had driven Mr. Roderick mad, and after that the ghost had
spoken to Mrs. Ayres and said awful things that made her kill herself.
And now the ghost had killed Miss Caroline, too, by drawing her up to the second landing and pushing or scaring her off it. The ghost
hadn't wanted her in the house, but it hadn't wanted her to go either. It was a spiteful ghost, and wanted the house all for its own.
I suppose that, having been repeatedly denied an audience at Hundreds itself, she was innocently determined to make the most of the one before her now. When there were murmurs from the crowd again, she raised her voice, and her tone grew stubborn. I glanced around the room and saw several people openly smiling. Most, however, were gazing at her in fascinated disbelief. Caroline's aunt and uncle looked outraged. The newspaper men, of course, were busily writing the whole thing down. Graham bent his head to me, frowning.
"You knew about all this?"
I didn't answer. The grotesque little story had come to its end, and Riddle was calling for order.
"Well," he said to Betty, when the room was silent, "you have told us a most extraordinary tale. Not being an expert on ghost hunting and so on, I hardly feel qualified to comment on it."
Betty flushed.
"It's true, sir. I ain't lying."
"Yes, all right. Let me just ask you this. Did Miss Ayres herself believe in the Hundreds ghost? Did she think it had done all those terrible things you've mentioned?"
"Oh, yes, sir. She believed it more than anyone."
Riddle looked grave.
"Thank you. We are very grateful to you. You have thrown a good deal of light, I think, on Miss Ayres's state of mind."
He waved her down. She hesitated, confused by his words and gesture. He dismissed her more plainly, and she went back to join her father. And then it was my turn. Riddle called me to the stand, and I rose and took my place, with a feeling almost of dread, almost as if this were some sort of criminal trial with myself as the accused. The clerk swore me in, and when I spoke I had to clear my throat and say the oath over again. I asked for water, and Riddle waited patiently while I drank it. Then he began his examination. He began it by briefly reminding the court of the evidence we had heard so far. Our task, he said, was to determine the circumstances surrounding Miss Eyre's fatal fall. And as far as he could see it, there were several possibilities still before us. Foul play, he thought, was not one of them. None of the pieces of evidence pointed that way. It seemed unlikely, too, given the report of Dr. Graham, that Miss Eyre had become physically ill, though it was perfectly possible that she had, for whatever reason, believed herself to be ill, and that belief might have startled or weakened her to the extent of causing her to fall. Or, if we kept in mind what the family maid claimed to have heard her cry out, we might conclude that she had been startled by something else, something she had seen or fancied she had seen, and had lost her footing as a result. Working against those theories, however, was the height and obvious solidity of the Hundred's banister rail. But there were two further possibilities. Both were forms of suicide. Miss Eyre might have flung herself from the landing as a way of taking her own life, in a premeditated act planned in the full clarity of mind, in other words, a philo de se, or she might have jumped deliberately, but in response to some delusion. He glanced over his notes, then turned to me. I was, he knew, the Eyre's family doctor. Miss Eyre and I had also, he was sorry to have to raise this, but he understood that Miss Eyre and I had recently been engaged to be married. He would attempt, he said, to keep his questions as delicate as possible, but he was anxious to establish all he could about Miss Eyre's emotional state on the night of her death, and he hoped I would help him. Clearing my throat again, I said I would do my best. He asked me when I had last seen Caroline. I answered that I had last seen her in the afternoon of the 16th of May, when I had visited the hall with Mrs. Graham, my partner's wife. He asked about Caroline's state of mind at that time. She and I had only very recently broken off our engagement. Was that correct? Yes, I said. Had the decision been a mutual one? You'll forgive my asking, I hope, he added, perhaps in response to my expression. What I'm trying to ascertain for the court is whether the separation might have left Miss Eyre unduly distressed. I glanced over at the jury and thought how much Caroline herself would have hated all this, how she would have loathed to think of us here in our black suits, picking over the last days of her life like crows in a cornfield. I said quietly, "No, I don't think it had left her in undue distress. She had had a change of heart, that's all. A change of heart, I see. And one of the effects of this change of heart, I believe, was that Miss Eyre had decided to sell her family home and leave the county. What did you make of that decision?" "Well, it surprised me. I thought it drastic."
"Drastic?"
"Unrealistic. Caroline had spoken of emigrating to America or Canada. She had spoken of possibly taking her brother with her."
"Her brother, Mr. Roderick Eyre, who is currently a patient at a private institution for mental cases?"
"Yes."
"His condition, I understand, is a grave one. Was Miss Eyre upset by his illness?"
"Naturally she was."
"Overly upset?"
I thought about it. "No, I wouldn't say that."
"Did she show you tickets or reservations or anything like that relating to this trip to America or Canada?"
"No."
"But you think she meant it, sincerely?"
"Well, as far as I know. She had the idea..." I paused.
"Well, that England didn't want her, that there was no place for her here now."
A couple of the gentry spectators nodded grimly at that. Riddle himself looked thoughtful and was silent for a moment, adding a note to the papers before him. Then he turned to the jury.
"I'm very interested in these plans of Miss Eyre's," he told them. "I'm wondering how seriously we ought to take them. On the one hand, you see, we've heard that she was about to begin a new life and was full of excitement about it. On the other, the plans might have struck you, as they struck Dr. Faraday, and I must confess they've struck me as rather unrealistic. No evidence exists to support them. All the evidence, in fact, suggests that Miss Eyre was far more concerned with ending a life than with beginning one. She had recently broken off an engagement of marriage. She had disposed of the bulk of her family's possessions.
and she was taking care to leave her empty home in good order. All this might speak to us of a suicide, carefully planned and reasoned. He turned back to me. "Dr. Faraday, did Miss Eyres ever strike you as the sort of person who might be capable of suicide?" I said, after a second, that I supposed any person might be capable of suicide, given the right conditions. "Did she ever mention suicide to you?" "No. Her mother, of course, had recently, and most tragically, taken her own life. That must have affected her." "It had affected her," I said. "In all the ways one would expect, it had put her in low spirits." "Would you say it had made her feel hopeless about life?" No, I wouldn't say that." He tilted his head. "Would you say it had affected the balance of her mind?" I hesitated. "The balance of a person's mind," I started at last, "is sometimes a difficult thing to gauge." "I am certain it is. That is why I am taking such pains to try and gauge the balance of Miss Eyres's. Did you ever have any doubts about it, Dr. Faraday? Any doubts at all? This change of heart, for example, over your wedding, did that seem in character to you?" After another hesitation, I admitted that Caroline had, in fact, seemed to me to have been behaving erratically in the final weeks of her life. He said, "What do you mean by erratically?" I said, "She was distant, not herself. She had odd ideas." "Odd ideas?" "About her family. And about her house." My voice sank on these words. Peering at me rather as he had peered at Betty, he said, "Did Miss Eyres ever mention ghosts or phantoms to you? Things like that?" I didn't answer. He went on, "We have all just heard a quite extraordinary account of life at Hundreds Hall from the family's maid. That is why I am asking. You'll appreciate, I think, that this is an important point. Did Miss Eyres ever at any time speak to you about ghosts or phantoms?" I said finally, "Yes, she did." There were more murmurs. This time Riddle ignored them. Looking fixedly at me, he said, "Miss Eyres seriously believed her home to be haunted?" I said, with reluctance, that Caroline had believed that the hall was in the grip of some sort of influence, a supernatural influence. "I don't think she ever believed in an actual ghost, but she believed she had seen evidence of this supernatural influence." "Yes." "What form did the evidence take?" I took a breath. "She believed that her brother had more or less been driven mad by it. She believed that her mother had been affected by it too. She believed, like the family maid, that the influence was responsible for her mother's suicide?" "Broadly, yes." "Did you encourage her in that belief?" "Of course I didn't. I deplored it. I thought it morbid. I tried my very best to discourage it, but the belief persisted." "Yes." "How do you account for that?" I said miserably, "I can't. I wish I could." "You don't think it was evidence of mental derangement?" "I don't know. I did. Caroline herself spoke to me of a family taint. She was afraid, I know that. But you have to understand, there were things that happened at the house. I don't know." He looked troubled, removing his spectacles to pinch at the bridge of his nose, and as he worked the wire arms back around his ears, he said, "I have to tell you, Dr. Faraday, I met Miss Eyres more than once. Many people in this room knew her far better than I did. All of us, I think, would agree that she was the most level-headed of young women. That the Hundreds parlour-maid should have given way to supernatural fancies is one thing, but for an intelligent, healthy, well-bred girl like Caroline Eyres to have come to suppose herself haunted, well, surely some quite serious deterioration must have taken place. This is a terribly sad case, and I realize it may be difficult for you to admit that someone for whom you once cared very deeply was of an unbalanced state of mind, but it seems pretty clear to me that what we are dealing with here is a case of inherited family madness, a family taint, in Miss Eyres's own expression. Could it be that when, in the seconds before she died, she called out, 'You,' it was in response to some hallucination, that the madness already had her in its grip? We will never know.
I am strongly inclined, however, to instruct the jury to return a verdict of suicide whilst of unsound mind. But I am not a doctor, he continued. You are the family physician, and I would like your support on that verdict. If you do not feel able to give me that support, you must say so very plainly, in which case my instruction to the jury may have to be different. Can you offer me that support or not? I gazed down at my hands. They were shaking slightly. The room was warmer than ever, and I was horribly aware of the juror's eyes. Again I had the sense that something was on trial here, something in which I was personally and guiltily involved. Was there a taint? Is that what had terrorized the family day after day, month by month, and finally destroyed it? That was what Riddle believed, clearly, and once I would have agreed with him. I would have set out the evidence just as he had, until it told the story I wanted it to tell, but my confidence in that story was shaken now. It seemed to me that the calamity that had overtaken Hundreds Hall was a far stranger thing, not a thing to be decided on neatly in a small, plain room in a court of law. But then, what was it? I looked up into the sea of watchful faces. I caught sight of Graham and Hepton and Seely. I think Seely nodded slightly, though whether he was urging me to speech or to silence I don't know. I saw Betty gazing at me with her light, bewildered eyes. Then across that image there came another, the Hundreds Landing, lit bright by the moon, and once again I seemed to see Caroline making her sure-footed way along it. I saw her doubtfully mounting the stairs, as if drawn upwards by a familiar voice. I saw her advance into the darkness, not quite certain of what was before her. Then I saw her face, saw it as vividly as the faces all around me. I saw recognition and understanding and horror in her expression, just for a moment as if it were there in the silvered surface of her moonlit eye. I even seemed to catch the outline of some shadowy, dreadful thing. I seized the wooden rail in front of me and heard Riddle say my name. The clerk hastily brought more water. There were more murmurs from the court, but the moment of giddiness had already passed, and the fragments of Hundreds' nightmare that I had glimpsed had retreated into darkness. And what did it matter now, anyway? Everything was finished, now. Wasted and gone. I wiped my face and stood more steadily, and turned to Riddle to say in a toneless voice that, yes, I would support him. I believed Caroline's mind in the last few weeks of her life to have become clouded, and her death to have been a suicide. He thanked me, and stood me down, then gave his summing up of the case. The jury retired, but with such a clear direction they had little to debate. They soon returned with the expected verdict, and after the usual formalities the inquest was closed. People stood, chairs scraped and grated. The voices rose up. I said to Graham, "For God's sake, let's go quickly, can we?" He put his hand under my elbow and steered me from the room. I didn't look at any of the newspapers that came out later that week, but I gather they made a great deal of Betty's account of Hundreds being haunted. I understand that a few ghoulish people even contacted a house agent, posing as prospective buyers in an attempt to be given a tour of the hall. And once or twice, when I was out on the Hundreds Road at that time, I saw cars or bicycles drawn up at the park gates, and people peering through the ironwork, as if the house had become an attraction for trippers, like a castle or a stately home. Caroline's funeral drew spectators for the same sort of reason, though it was kept as modest as possible by her uncle and aunt, with no pealing of the church bell, no display of flowers, and no wake. The crowd of actual mourners was small, and I stayed well to the back of it. I took along the unworn wedding ring, and held it in my pocket, and turned and turned it between my fingers as the coffin was lowered. Chapter 15. That was just over 3 years ago. Since then I have kept very busy. When the new health service arrived, I didn't, as I'd feared I would, lose patients. In fact, I gained them, probably partly as a result of my connection with the Ayreses, for, like those Oxfordshire squatters, many people had come across my name in the local papers and seemed to see me as a sort of coming man. I'm told now that I'm popular, that my manner is down to earth,
I still practice out of Dr. Gill's old place at the top of Lidcote High Street. It still suits a bachelor. Well enough. But the village is rapidly expanding. There are many new young families, and the consulting room and dispensary look increasingly out of date. Graham, Seely, and I have begun to talk of combining practices in a brand new health centre, with Morris Babb to build it. Roderick's condition, unfortunately, has failed to improve. I had hoped that the loss of his sister might finally release him from his delusion. For what, I thought, could he possibly still have to fear from hundreds after that? But Caroline's death, if anything, has had the opposite effect. He blames himself for all the tragedies, and seems bent on self-punishment. He has burnt and bruised and scalded himself so many times, he's now kept almost permanently sedated, and is the shadow of the boy he once was. I go to see him when I can. That is easier than it used to be, because with the final drying up of the family income, it became impossible for him to remain at Dr. Warren's rather costly private clinic. These days he is a patient at the county mental hospital, sharing a ward with 11 other men. The council houses on the edge of Hundreds Park have been a great success, so much so that last year a dozen more were added, and others are planned. Many of the families are on my list, so I'm out there quite often. The houses are cosy enough, with neat flower and vegetable gardens, and swings and slides set up for the children. Only one real change has been made, and that is that the chain-link fences at the rear of the estate have been replaced by a fence of wood. The families themselves requested this. It seems that none of them much enjoyed gazing out from their back windows at the hall. They said the house gave them the creeps. Stories about the Hundreds ghost continue to circulate, mainly among the younger people and the newcomers, people with no real knowledge of the Ayreses themselves. The most popular tale, I gather, is that the hall is haunted by the spirit of a servant girl who was badly treated by a cruel master and who jumped or was pushed to her death from one of the upstairs windows. She's regularly seen in the park, apparently, weeping and weeping as though her heart will break. I bumped into Betty once, on the road in front of the houses. One of the families living out there is related to hers. It was a few months after Caroline's death. I saw a young woman and a young man coming out through a garden gate as I was parking my car. A minute later I drew in my door to let them pass, and the young woman paused and said, "Don't you know me, Dr. Faraday?" I looked into her face and saw those wide grey eyes of hers and her little crooked teeth. I wouldn't have recognized her otherwise. She was wearing a cheap summer frock with a fashionable swing to its skirt. Her colourless hair had been lightened and permed. Her lips and cheeks were red with rouge. She was still small, but her slightness had gone, or else she'd found some artificial way to improve her figure. I suppose she was almost 16. She told me she was still living with her parents, and her mother was still carrying on. But she'd at last got the sort of job she wanted, in a bicycle factory. The work was dull enough, but the other girls were a laugh. She had her evenings and her weekends to herself, and often went dancing up in Coventry. She kept her arm through that of her young man all the time she spoke. He looked about 22 or 23, almost the same age as Roderick. She made no reference to the inquest, or to Caroline's death, and I began to think as she chattered on that she wasn't going to mention Hundreds at all, as if the whole dark interlude had left no mark on her. But then the people she had been visiting looked out of their house and called to the young man, and once he had moved off, her bright manner seemed slightly to fade. I said quietly, "You don't mind coming so close to Hundreds, then, Betty?" She blushed and shook her head. "I wouldn't go back in the house, though. Not for £1,000. I have dreams about it all the time."
"Do you?"
I never dreamt about it now.
"Not bad dreams," she said.
She wrinkled up her nose.
"Funny dreams. I dream most about Mrs. Ayres. I dream she tries to give me things, jewels and brooches and things like that. And I never want to take them, I don't know why. And in the end it makes her cry. Poor Mrs. Ayres. She was such a nice lady. Miss Caroline, too. It wasn't fair, was it, what happened to them?"
I agreed that it wasn't. We stood sadly for a moment with nothing more to say. I thought what a very unremarkable pair we must have made to anybody watching, and yet out of the wreckage of that terrible year, she and I were the only survivors. Then her young man ambled back to us, and she grew pert again. She gave me her hand in farewell, put her arm through his, and they headed off towards the bus stop. I saw them still there 20 minutes later when I returned to my car. They were larking about on the bench. He had pulled her into his lap, and she was kicking up her legs and laughing. Hundreds Hall is still unsold. No one has the money or the inclination to take it on. For a while there was talk of the county council making a teacher training centre of it, then a Birmingham businessman apparently considered it for an hotel. But the rumours surface and come to nothing, and recently they've begun to surface less often. Probably the look of the place has begun to put people off. For, of course, the gardens are hopelessly overgrown now, and the terrace has been lost to the weeds. Children have chalked on the walls and thrown stones at the windows, and the house seems to sit in the chaos like some wounded, blighted beast. I go out there whenever my busy days will allow. None of the locks has been changed, and I still have my keys. Very occasionally I'll find that someone has been there in my absence, a tramp or a squatter, and has tried to force the door. The doors are solid ones, however, and on the whole the hall's reputation keeps outsiders away. And there is nothing to steal, for what Caroline failed to sell in the weeks before she died, her uncle and aunt disposed of. The downstairs rooms I tend to keep shuttered. The second floor has been giving me some anxiety lately. There are holes appearing in the roof where slates have been lost in bad weather. A family of swallows has come right into the old day nursery and built a nest there. I put down pails to catch the rainwater, and have boarded up the worst of the broken windows. Every so often I go right through the house, sweeping up the dust and the mouse dirt. The saloon ceiling still holds, though it can only be a matter of time before the bloated stucco tumbles. Caroline's bedroom continues to fade. Roderick's room, even now, smells faintly of burning. Despite all this, the house retains its beauty. In some ways it is handsomer than ever, for without the carpets and the furniture and the clutter of occupation, one appreciates the lines and Georgian symmetries, the lovely shifts between shadow and light, the gentle progression of the rooms. Wandering softly through the twilit spaces, I can even seem to see the house as its architect must have done when it was new, with its plaster detail fresh and unchipped, its surfaces unblemished. In those moments there is no trace of the Ayreses at all. It is as if the house has thrown the family off, like springing turf throwing off a footprint. I am no nearer now to understanding just what happened at the hall than I was 3 years ago. Once or twice I've spoken about it to Seely. He has come down firmly in favour of his old, rational view that Hundreds was, in effect, defeated by history, destroyed by its own failure to keep pace with a rapidly changing world. In his opinion, the Ayreses, unable to advance with the times, simply opted for retreat, for suicide and madness. Right across England, he says, other old gentry families are probably disappearing in exactly the same way. The theory is convincing enough, and yet sometimes I'm troubled. I remember poor, good-tempered Jip. I recall those mysterious black smudges on the walls and ceiling of Roderick's room. I picture the three little drops of blood that I once saw springing to the surface of Mrs. Ayres's silk blouse. And I think of Caroline. I think of Caroline in the moments before she died, advancing across that moonlit landing. I think of her crying out, "You!" I've never attempted to remind Seely of his other, odder theory, that Hundreds was consumed by some dark germ, some ravenous shadow creature, some little stranger spawned from the troubled unconscious of someone connected with the house itself. But on my solitary visits I find myself growing watchful. Every so often I'll sense a presence, or catch a movement at the corner of my eye, and my heart will give a jolt of fear and expectation. I'll imagine that the secret is about to be revealed to me at last, that I will see what Caroline saw, and recognize it as she did. If Hundreds Hall is haunted, however, its ghost doesn't show itself to me, for I'll turn, and I am disappointed, realizing that what I'm looking at is only a cracked window-pane, and that the face gazing distortedly from it, baffled and longing, is my own. This is Simon Vance. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Dan Musselman. The Little Stranger is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Books on Tape. Copyright 2009. All rights reserved. The book, The Little Stranger, is available wherever Riverhead books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.